Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection. Many people believe American children are being over-medicated for depression, anxiety, attention disorders, and bipolar disease. Welcome to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we'll be discussing the diagnosis and treatment of disorders in children and adolescents, or mental health disorders, I should say. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@kska.org. My guest today is Judith Warner. She's best known for the New York Times bestseller, Perfect Madness, Motherhood and the Age of Anxiety. She's a New York Times correspondent, wrote a column for the New York Times in the past. She's been a foreign correspondent in Paris as well, and recently she's addressed this whole issue of mental health disorders in children and how we're handling that in this country, and she's published a book on her research called We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. Judith, welcome to Line 1.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I want to start today, the logical thing is, why did you set out to write this book? But I think a better introduction was something in your preface where you state, quote, your aim was to, quote, articulate a new way to be more realistically, compassionately, and productively think about and help very vulnerable population of kids. And then you contrasted that aim of yours with a quote from Rush Limbaugh, who explained ADHD as, quote, the perfect way to explain inattention, incompetence, and inability of adults to control their kids. Why did you do that?
Well, I think that Rush Limbaugh's point of view that ADHD is just a question of badly behaved kids and is symptomatic not of anything really wrong with the kids, but of something that's gone wrong with their parents, meaning that their parents aren't rising to the responsibilities of disciplining them or structuring their lives. You know, that point of view is very, very common. There's a kind of skepticism generally about children's mental health disorders, about depression or bipolar disorder or anxiety or other things in children. But ADHD has always been the flashpoint, the disorder that people kind of roll their eyes about the most, because it is the most common of the childhood disorders. And there's a very strong impression in our country that it's being grossly overdiagnosed and that kids with really nothing wrong with them are being labeled. And I used to feel that too. And, you know, when I started putting together the research and when I started changing my mind on the subject, which I did very completely, you know, 180-degree turnaround, it was embarrassing for me to look back and find these words of Rush Limbaugh's and realize that there had been a time where I could have been just nodding along with him.
So how long did you take to come to this change in framework of point of view?
I would say it took about 2.5 years, years in which I was supposed to be writing the book and making good progress with it, and in which I really was kind of just spinning my wheels, because I realized very early on, once I embarked on this project, and the point of the project in the first place, the initial assignment, was to write a book on overdiagnosis and overmedication, basically how pushy, competitive parents were trying to perfect their kids. And the only way they could do that often, the only way they could make them rise to the unnatural challenges of our times, was by medicating them, or by, you know, finding some cooked up disorders in them. You know, that was a book that I was supposed to write. Mm-hmm. And the problem was that once I started to try to really write it and do something other than just kind of recycle received wisdom or quotations that I'd already found in the media or statistics that were floating around in the media, I found that I didn't have anything solid to build on. And, you know, I kept trying to reconceive the idea to make it work. Okay, I wasn't writing about all mental health disorders. I was just going to write about the bogus disorders like ADHD. And then I would think, well, wait, you know, with my master's degree in comparative literature, where exactly do I have the expertise to come up with these sorts of judgments about what's a real disorder and what's a bogus disorder? So it was, I often thought it was like being in quicksand, you know. I would try to dig my way out, and when I think I was digging out conceptually, the whole thing would collapse back down on me again. And that went on for a long, long time.
You know, one of the things that caught my attention about the book, not only is it well written and addresses a very important issue, is your willingness to address an issue, change your mind, follow the facts, which is something on this program we're constantly getting people to hopefully think about doing at least. But it is very, very tough. Scientists are as guilty as anyone about having preconceived ideology notions and not willing to investigate the other side. I think this is remarkable. I'm not sure I'm a great expert on what's written out there, but I would like to just say up front, I think this is a very good example of how people should address particular issues. And I'm sure it wasn't easy for you. People must have been giving you a hard time about it as well and wondering whether you'd gone crazy.
It was tough, and I have to say thank you. I really appreciate hearing you say that, especially since it was a really tough slog for a number of years, and I don't think my publisher was very happy about the turnaround that I made since that wasn't the book that they had acquired. But, of course, it was taking so long that they just wanted to get a book and be able to publish something, so I was able to get away with it. But, you know, you get to a point where you realize that what you set out to do simply isn't true, that it's just wrong. And then you get to know people better. I mean, what I started to do, I began talking to doctors, and it was the doctors who surprised me because I had gone specifically to doctors first who I'd seen quoted in the media saying things that I thought backed up my initial point of view. Then I would actually interview them, and they would say, well, no, that wasn't so much what they meant. Yeah, ADHD was real. Yes, bipolar disorder, even if it's being overdiagnosed in a lot of kids right now, is real and does exist. And they would say to me, you know, the real problem in our country is underdiagnosis, not overdiagnosis. This coming from doctors who I had seen quoted in articles on overdiagnosis and overmedication. So, you know, I listened to them. When I looked at statistics, too, the statistics just didn't back up the overdiagnosis and overmedication belief. And then I started talking to parents. When I realized that I was on the wrong track, I thought, you know, I've really got to learn something and have some clue about what I'm actually writing about. I have to learn what these disorders are, and I also have to learn what the parents and kids are actually going through so that I could, you know, relay their stories rather than just discoursing on their stories, you know, making up my own stories. And when I heard their stories, it became that much more important to me on a gut level to tell the truth and to have people see the truth, because I could see the incredible harm that was done to families by all of the stigma and the prejudicial way that we tend to talk about this issue.
Was there a particular family or incident that made you really, you know, when you get down in the family, talking to the family, talking to mothers, I'm going to assume to a large degree, seeing these kids, that you can recall or want to share?
Well, the funny thing is, and I think, you know, it gets back to what you were saying about people's preconceptions. I had close to me a family who I'd known for years who were struggling with extremely serious mental health issues in the son. You know, issues that were pretty mysterious. He'd had kind of every diagnosis possible, and he had been taking all kinds of different medications. And I still stuck to my belief that medication didn't work and that, you know, these diagnoses were somehow not real. And I, early on when I got my book contract, I talked to my friend about it. This was a close friend, and I told her what direction I was going in. You know, and she's not the kind of person who has sort of overt conflict. So she just sort of looked at me and shrugged and said, okay, how do you know all that? And, you know, I registered at the time that there was some kind of discord and that she wasn't thrilled about this idea. But it took years for it actually to sink in that I was sitting in her living room and telling her that her son's problems were a social construct, you know, that they weren't real, that they were symptomatic of what was wrong with our society. And when I think back on that, you know, I can't believe that the words came out of my mouth. So what's funny thinking back is how obtuse I was. And it's sort of once I realized that, then all the stories just confirmed what I knew then to be the truth. And, you know, I was just struck again and again by how much some of these kids were suffering and how much the parents were suffering along with them.
Mm-hmm. How'd your friend respond as the conversation developed? Did she indulge you with
what she... No, she spent hours talking to me.
Ah,
And she's become just a huge supporter of the book, and has been, you know, incredibly supportive in helping me try to get the word out and tell other people about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, my wife and I know several. I know several women and families, particularly women, and my wife has some friends too that. It's very demanding in some of these situations, and yet at the same time, there are overdiagnoses. There will always be, but I think as you learned, I think we also are still struggling with getting people to talk about it. That it's still underdiagnosed and certainly undertreated. And I guess we ought to ask one of the fundamental questions people might have is it that we're seeing more of it because of something we do, or are we recognizing these problems more? That's one of the fundamental issues we ought to talk about.
And, you know, that was one of the earliest questions I asked, and the question that I asked through all the years of my research, and never got a definite answer. What is definitely true, what we know for sure, is that we are diagnosing more children than in the past, that we're recognizing these children more and sort of capturing what's going on with children better and better. Whether there absolutely are more children, you know, really objectively are more children with mental health problems than in the past, there's absolutely no way to know, because we didn't have the same definitions of diagnoses going back through the decades. It wasn't believed that a lot of the disorders that kids are diagnosed with now could actually exist in children going back. You know, until the 70s, it wasn't believed that children could suffer from the depression. Autism, as everyone knows, was defined very, very narrowly back in the 40s. When the exact description of autism came into use. And now we talk about autism spectrum disorder, so of course that includes millions and millions more children. Bipolar disorder was believed to begin only in young adulthood. Now doctors agree that it does exist in younger children, although not in anywhere near the numbers that are being diagnosed right now. So we know all of that is factually true. We know that there's been a certain amount of diagnostic substitution, say, with autism, where children who were previously called mentally retarded are now being called autistic. But we will never know whether the absolute numbers are increasing because the data just doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. And the perfectly honest scientist is going to say we don't know because they exactly what you said. We just don't. We're trying to compare different times, different diagnoses, different bounce of information about what these disorders are. Some of them didn't have the right name to them even in those periods. So it is difficult. Let me stop for just a second and remind our listeners, my guest today is Judith Warner, our author of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. We're talking about the issue of medication and diagnosis of mental health issues in children. If you've got questions or comments, two phone numbers you can call and reach us over the next 45 minutes or so. 550-8433 is our toll-free, or is our regular number here in Anchorage, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email me during the next 45 minutes, as I said, at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. I have the same issue has come up a number of times about autism and whether we have an increased incident or not. And there has been an interesting study that maybe could be done in the same way to look at whether autism has really increased. And what it was done in England, where they took people by decade of birth and used the same diagnostic criteria that we use today, and they found the same percentage of people with a diagnosis of autism who were 70 to 80 years of age, 40 to 50 years of age, and 0 to 10 years of age. So
that's very interesting.
Yeah,
I wasn't aware of that study.
That was a different way. It's just been recently published, and it just goes in. I mean, what's happening is we're certainly increasing our information. We're broadening our diagnostic categories. We're aware of people with milder forms of various disorders, and that includes diabetes and arthritis and everything else. And so it does make it look like we're seeing more and more of it, but we got to be careful. Maybe it's just we're better at making the diagnosis, and we've begin to recognize milder forms of the same process.
And the children are more visible generally. Yeah. You know, even as late as the 1980s, you had children with mental health disorders who were put in institutions
Absolutely.
For long periods of time.
Yep.
Now, when going back further, let's say to the, you know, to the 60s, they could be put away for years. And by the 80s, it was down, let's say, to a matter of weeks or a couple months. But, you know, you had insurance changes after that. Insurance companies were no longer willing to pay for long stays in hospitals. And so you had kids who were sort of cycling in and out of institutions much more quickly, and you had a lot more medications that could be used with children. So very sick children who in the past wouldn't have been able to live at home and go to school are able to do it because they take these medications. And, you know, the medications are so demonized because they're so powerful, because they can have terrible side effects. But, you know, for some of these kids, it's a life or death situation, and it's really the difference between being able to function and in family life and in school and not being able to function at all.
Why do you say it's a, I want to put a face on this difficulty, life or death situation. You know, sometimes I don't think parents understand the day-to-day difficulty, the risk to children of hurting themselves and others with some of these disorders.
Well, you know, with the disorder that's considered the most banal, ADHD, which of course is way less serious, let's say, than bipolar disorder or something like schizophrenia, which, of course, is very uncommon in young children. But, you know, some of these kids are so impulsive that they run out in the street into traffic. There was one mother of a little boy who wrote to me at the Times after I had written something on this subject, and I don't think this actually made it into the book, where she was, you know, in part of an online discussion about medication with a lot of people writing in and saying, you know, how could these parents drug their kids? It's terrible. And she said, if I had had medication for my little boy, he might still be here with me today. When he was 8 years old, he ran out between two cars and was killed. And I was one of those parents who was adamantly opposed to medication, you know, and I beat myself up for it every day. Now, that's
sure.
an extreme example, of course, but these things do exist. You know, these disorders can be serious to that point. There's a wonderful documentary that was made last year called Boy Interrupted that showed on HBO. And it was made by a mother, a filmmaker, whose son was bipolar. He was diagnosed quite young. He started to talk about killing himself when he was about 7. And he was diagnosed as bipolar, took lithium. And when he was 15, he was doing so well that he wanted to go off his medication, and his psychiatrist agreed, and they lowered his dosage greatly, and he finally succeeded in killing himself. So, you know, it's nobody wants to give children medication. Nobody mm-hmm. likes doing yeah. it. No parent likes doing it. But sometimes it really is the difference between life and death.
Mm-hmm. We've got a caller, and I'd like to go ahead and take Bob's comments. Bob, you're on line one.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard, and hello, Judith. It's been wonderful to read your column in the Times over the years.
Thank you.
And I'd like to second everything that Dr. Woodard said. I think it takes real courage to stand up to a publisher and do the right thing. So good for you.
Thank you.
We had kids diagnosed with ADHD, and they came from bipolar roots, so we paid a lot of attention to seeking the right treatment, including medications. And the result, I think, was distinctly muddled. First of all, the problem was somewhat subtle. It was mainly ability to concentrate and that kind of thing, and high-achieving kids that weren't doing as well as they might have. So we might fall on the other side of the spectrum of... Sorry for the background. I'm at the airport. But kids that were treated that some would argue probably shouldn't have been, there should have been, if not more parental discipline, just something short of medications, and it's hard to say that the medications had a dramatic result. So I'm just wondering how much ends up distinctly in the middle there, where you can't condemn it, but you can't praise it either for the results.
I think, you know, one thing, it needs to be said that medication is not a panacea, and there are a lot of disorders where children do just as well or better with therapy, particularly cognitive behavioral therapy. And I think that, you know, most child psychiatrists will want to start a child on therapy before medication is used, if that's a possibility for kids. It's very expensive, and insurance doesn't cover it very well. ADHD is different because, you know, there isn't necessarily therapy you can do for inattention. It sounds like the child you're describing suffered primarily from inattention. And, you know, if you can't keep your mind on a series of numbers over a period of time to do a sheet of math homework, you know, there isn't a whole lot of therapy that can get you to do it. I think that often parents do find themselves with kids who are less strongly affected kind of in a spot where it's difficult to decide what the right thing is to do. And in that case, they have to go with their gut. And I think it often comes down to whether their children are suffering or not. You know, you can have kids who maybe test as having ADHD, but who aren't having any problems. They have friends, they're happy, they do fine in school, they're not stressed, they're fine, basically. So why do anything? And then you have kids, you know, where maybe on the one hand it's not all that clear, but on the other hand the kid's really distressed, really upset about missing conversations, let's say not being able to function socially or make friends, having just way too hard a time with homework than they should given their intelligence and their skills. You know, and then if you see a child is really suffering, it can be a great thing to be able to help them. But I think parents know in their gut what the right thing is to do, and hopefully they can find doctors who will really listen to them and really listen to the kid and be able to take the time to do the kind of evaluation and follow-up that's necessary to make sure that the right decision is taken. And also, you know, that decision can change over time.
Right. Okay. Well, may I just mention that we've had a wonderful run up here in Anchorage. We had Ira Glass in town yesterday, and we launched a 40,000-plus pound statue at the museum yesterday morning. So, it's been a great run in Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah. Thanks for your call, Bob.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right. I have an email that came in, Judith, kind of at the other end of the spectrum, but it runs the same philosophical line, and it basically says, I'm well informed and very sympathetic to those with mental illness. However, with changes in law and health care over the last generation, little can be done to help chronically mentally ill adults. For example, I have a neighbor who is clearly ill, depressed, hears voices, has a significant insomnia, and yet will not seek treatment. Her family has given up on her almost, and they've tried to have her hospitalized. She's been visited by the police. The neighbors are afraid of her and avoid her. What can be done?
That's a terrible situation. Yeah. And you hear this kind of thing all the time. You know, patients' rights groups, right, undoubtedly well-intentioned at the outset, have worked and advocated to change laws so that it is very, very difficult to commit someone for treatment now. They have to pose an immediate threat to themselves or other people. And so you have a lot of people who aren't getting treatment because they don't see themselves as having problems, so they're not going to go in and accept treatment or request treatment. And you hear terrible stories with children often that the parents can't get them in for treatment, especially once they're a certain age, until they commit a crime. So you have college-age kids, for example, who don't get mental health care, whose parents cannot get them in for care, and who end up doing something, getting picked up by the police, and end up in jail, where, of course, they don't get proper mental health care either. It's a very, very serious problem. I don't know of any movement afoot, really, to rethink these laws, but clearly there ought to be.
Here's another email, another one I think that you will identify with very, very well. As a parent of a child with ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder and suspected being bipolar, I've struggled with accepting these diagnoses. It took me a long time to realize that we need to medicate my child. It is a decision that I do not, and capitalize not, take lightly. It was not something I wanted to do, but one of the tools that helps my daughter cope with her life. My question is, how do I politely explain to, quote, know-it-all, end quote, parents that the choice to medicate is scientifically supported? Is there an easy resource that I can quote from?
Well, I really hate being the self-serving author, but I often think with this book, I think to myself, you know, give it to those people. Give
Absolutely.
It to the know-it-all people.
Absolutely. I would second that. I think it's not necessarily scientifically, but you've well documented with your bibliography and everything. So I think it is a good idea.
It's heavily, heavily documented. And it's just that, I'll tell you why I say this. When I wrote it, I had in mind almost a person who I was arguing with. There was actually a reporter I knew who reported on the pharmaceutical industry and was vehemently against the use of medication in children.
Couldn't you just put Rush Limbaugh's picture up on your
pretty much. So when I formed my chapters, when I structured the arguments, it was really with all of these questions in mind, which of course had been my questions in the first place,
right.
You know, and my attitudes in the first place. So sort of talking back to that, and you know, the problem is that having a child with mental illness, you know, with mental health issues, is an experience that is so different in kind from what parents often go through. And people think that they understand, and they think they can generalize from their own experience. So if their children have sometimes been sad and they manage to cheer them up, they think you ought to be able to do the same thing. If they were able to get their children work better on their homework by, I don't know, eliminating red food dye, they think you should be able to do the same thing. And they don't understand that when children really are diagnosed with mental health issues, that there is a difference in kind, that there's a difference of degree, and there's a degree of impairment that's different from what other children go through. And I think it's very hard to break through that wall of misunderstanding. And I do think that it's through anecdotes, it's through empathy and being able to put yourself in the skin of somebody who's gone through it. And I really tried hard in the book to do that, to put parents' stories out there, not only so that other parents going through something similar could find themselves on the page, but also so that people who really don't understand could maybe connect empathetically, finally, to these families.
Okay, thanks very much. And I would strongly encourage, a great place to start with the answer to your question would be, we've got issues, children and parents in the age of medication. I think you'll...
I'd also like to add that the National Institute of Mental Health has a really excellent website with information on all of these disorders and sort of the current state of the science, you know, what are the generally accepted treatments. And the information is very clearly presented and manages to be relatively concise and yet complete. And I think it's a really good place to refer people to, you know, to get greater understanding in an easy and quick way.
And for those who are listening, if you go to KSKA.org/line1, you can go to that link with the National Institute of Mental Health. We've added that on our program notes for this program as well. Well, one of the issues that keeps parents, I think, from addressing these issues is they often are worried that it may be a reflection of poor parenting on their part, even though it seems to me there's often, when they stop and think of it, they can see that there's a family history suggesting that there's some genetic link in that. And it's human nature to feel guilty about these things as well.
It really is. And of course, in our current parenting culture, parents feel guilty about everything anyway. I mean, that's something that characterizes this age, is that, you know, mothers in particular feel like they're responsible for absolutely everything about their children and, you know, feel like they have the power to control everything. So, you know, of course, if there's a mental health problem, they feel like that too. But we also have a long history behind us of parent blaming when it comes to mental disorders. You know, the whole Freudian period that, you know, lodged so strongly here in the 1930s and you know, really held sway through the 70s, even, you know, to a large extent into the 80s, just held that whatever went wrong with children, whatever went wrong with people generally, had to do with their parenting. I mean, this is just a solid part of our pop culture that's only now starting to be chipped away at. Even though, you know, the thinking in psychiatry shifted a few decades ago, that thinking is just, you know, it's just changing in the culture. And people like to say no one takes responsibility anymore, everyone blames the brain, you know, it's the era of blaming the brain. But that's not really how people feel about things or think about things. Everyone's first reflex still when something goes wrong with a child is to blame the parents.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. You can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@kska.org. After this short break, we're going to continue to take your calls and emails and talk with Judith Warner on Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Judith Warner, and we're talking about her book, We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. If you've got questions or comments you'd like to have aired, why don't you give us a call, 550-8433. You can reach us by a toll-free number as well, 1-888-353-5752, and email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Please remember, if you're listening tonight between 8 and 9 local time, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, and we won't be available to take your call or email at that time. Judith, are there other important issues that are factors that you know of that lead to this perception that mental health issues in children are being overblown and that kids are over-medicated that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, I mean, the behavior of the pharmaceutical industry hasn't helped at all. Direct-to-consumer advertising has created such a trivialized image in the public mind of mental health disorders. You know, you see these ads describing disorders in ways that make any of us think that we have them. I mean, and then it becomes kind of a joke. We become very cynical about it. You know, if you're going to show, you know, the World Trade Center coming down in the weeks after 9/11, as happened back in 2001 with, I think it was Paxil ads, and then ask people if they're anxious, you know, we can quickly become very cynical about how the pharmaceutical industry is trying to pathologize all of us and, you know, get us all on medication. So I think that that has played a strong and really negative role in public perceptions. The news stories that have come out describing how some psychiatrists, including some very prominent child psychiatrists, were essentially in the pay of the drug makers, you know, taking money to do lectures, to have their names put on papers that were ghostwritten for them, you know, helping advance the commercial aims of drug makers has just undermined the profession terribly, the credibility of the profession. Even if it's, you know, a relatively small number who were doing that, they cast a really large shadow on all the rest. And the information about how drug money circulates really is damning. And I think that the American Psychiatric Association is going to have to do a lot, you know, in the coming years to try to free itself from some of this money and continuing medical education and other programs, and to sort of clean up their act so that people can trust psychiatrists again. You know, it was a field that was already not terribly well thought of, and this has just made things much, much worse.
There's another issue, and that's the fear of medications themselves, and I think that could be exemplified primarily easily with fairly accurate information, at least suggesting that the newer antidepressive agents, the so-called SSRIs, may have been and possibly still are slightly related to an increased risk of suicide in certain teenagers in the younger age group. So what about medication fears, medication worries too?
Worries about side effects, including very, very serious side effects, are well-founded. I mean, these side effects exist undeniably. You know, with the atypical antipsychotics, this is the group of medications people tend to be the most worried about right now, more so than the SSRIs, because they have really serious health risks. Children gain an enormous amount of weight when they take these medications. They're at risk for diabetes and for heart problems. And these medications, one perverse effect of the fears about SSRIs has been that these atypical antipsychotics are being prescribed more, often by pediatricians, as it turns out. There's some new polling that shows because they're afraid to use SSRIs now. So, you know, and the SSRI fears probably would have been better contained if the drug companies, if it hadn't come out that the drug companies had sat on negative results. You know, there was a basic dishonesty going on with this information in the first place that I think made people all the more fearful and suspicious for good reason. You know, at the same time, you talk to most psychiatrists and child psychiatrists, and they'll say the SSRIs have been in use now for over 20 years and are basically safe. They can lead to more suicidal thinking in teens and young adults, but not necessarily to more suicidal behavior, to actual suicides. And the suicide rate went down considerably in the years in which they were in greater use, and then actually went back up again in the period when people were afraid to prescribe them. So it's a, you know, it's a very, all of these things, they are really complicated issues. There are no black and white answers. You know, all of these require a kind of yes, but approach. And, you know, it's difficult to convey that kind of yes, butness to people often in news reports. So it's great that we can have this kind of conversation to talk about it with more of the nuance.
Those who listen to the program frequently will know I've said this a number of times. I think it's important for patients to understand that the question when you're talking about any treatment is not just what's the risk of treatment, but it also has to be balanced with what's the risk, doctor, of not treating. And that's where this SSRI issue meets the road. As you said, it's very clear that the risk of adolescent suicide was declining with the use of SSRIs until the concerns came out, which perhaps are real but minor compared to the fact that the death rate from suicide started increasing again, and now you're bringing up the point that maybe other medications that may even have greater risks are being used.
And, you know, but that's such an essential point that you just said about the risks of non-treatment, but it's something that we as parents really tend not to think about.
Right.
We fear treatments. We fear medicines, and we tend to think that if we do nothing, at least we're safe. At least we're not exposing our children to those risks. And we tend not to understand because we don't know until terrible things happen about the risks of non-treatment. You know, the risks of not treating ADHD, for example, you have higher rates of car accidents, of teenage pregnancy, of later alcohol and illicit drug use because people self-medicate. We don't realize that those risks are there. And of course, as you just referred to, the risks of non-treatment of depression, you know, can be suicide.
I think for me, for many pediatricians practicing today, the bipolar issue is the poster child of this discussion we're having for the medical community. I think most of us are well aware of autism, well aware of depression, well aware of ADHD, well aware of the benefits of treatment. We've been drawn slowly, or let me talk about this personally. I've been drawn slowly into the bipolar issue. Do you want to discuss that issue? Do you feel comfortable discussing that? Did you see kids with this diagnosis? And what did you find when you talked to parents with that?
That's, you know, it's the most, at least to me, I suppose, because it's the newest and most controversial aspect of all of this. You know, I find it the most interesting part of the discussion because it's so complicated. You know, it used to be thought, as I said before, that you couldn't even have bipolar disorder in young teens. Now it's, I think, pretty well accepted that you can. You started then having research out of Boston from Joseph Biederman and at Harvard and some others who followed him, saying that you could have bipolar disorder in very, very young children, even toddlers. That has not been widely accepted, and there are a lot of doctors who absolutely contest that you can make that kind of judgment in the youngest children. And the problem with the bipolar diagnosis as well is that it leads to the use of atypical antipsychotics and mood stabilizers, which are very powerful and potentially very dangerous. And the problem with the way, with what's happened with the bipolar diagnosis and broadening it out to a larger number of children is that the criteria for making that diagnosis have been changed in order to fit children. So that whereas an adult, if you talk about mania, you know, there's an established idea of what mania is, this kind of greatly elevated mood and a sense of omnipotence and, you know, sort of periods of not sleeping, not needing sleep, and, you know, having this unusually high energy and inflated sense of self and going on spending binges and, you know, things like that. And it's supposed to last for a pretty decent amount of time and then alternate with periods of depression. In children, you don't have all of that. Mania was redefined or reconceptualized so that irritability could count as mania. And the whole idea of mood cycling was changed so that rather than moods lasting for days or weeks or months even, that the moods could cycle a number of times within the course of the day. And there are a lot of critics who say if you change the criteria that much in order to make the label fit, then you're not talking about bipolar disorder, you're talking about something else. And I find that very convincing, and I get the sense that the predominance of medical opinion holds that what's happened with bipolar disorder is not convincing and that it's being really overdiagnosed in kids. You know, so you see this effort now in the attempts to put together a new DSM, the sort of Bible of the psychiatric community for the discussions for DSM-5, to come up with a new diagnosis that could be used for some of these kids who are now getting the bipolar label but who aren't really bipolar.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps we can come back to the bipolar and maybe even talk a little bit of how we talk as comorbid, because sometimes lots of issues get confounded in ADHD and bipolar with depression and oppositional defiant, and it can be extremely complex. But before we do that, and I'd like to go ahead and take another caller that we have. Mark, you're on line one.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd just like to speak to the issue of whether parents should be considering drug therapy for things like ADHD or ADD and so forth. And I'm 56 years old, and, of course, we didn't know much about those things back in the 50s and the 60s when I was growing up, and my parents, the reports that they got from my teachers over the years were classical, you know, attention deficit problems, things like that. I think I've managed to succeed in spite of that in a relatively high-stress profession, and I only recently began working with my doctor who suspected ADD, to treat that with, you know, medication. And it was like a light switch was flipped on. And if I had only known years ago, what could be accomplished with drug therapy, I honestly believe it would have made a huge difference in my life. And I can't fault my parents because they didn't know about this stuff. But parents today have that option, and if they're working with a doctor they trust, and that's an option that comes up as a possible, you know, alternative, I believe that it, you know, should be pursued. And quite frankly, I would kind of fault my parents if they'd known about it and hadn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But obviously they didn't, so I just feel like I'm kind of a case example. At my age, at age 56, you know, it's just worth putting my 2 cents in there.
Yeah, hang on for just a second. Judith?
I'm curious to ask you, because as you say that, you know, you dealt with your problems, you got through life, and you're successful in your career, what led you to even consider seeking treatment then?
Well, I've dealt with issues like anxiety and stuff like that, or that's, you know, we think that we're looking at the wrong thing, you know, in the past few years and stuff. And like I say, I've just weathered a high-stress world for years and years. My wife has suggested to me a number of years ago that, and she's an RN, and has suggested to me that I might be ADD. And when my doctor began to suspect that, we ran me through the short list of questions that kind of identify those traits, and that was just me to a T.
Mm-hmm. The reason I asked the question was just, I think often people who are skeptical, you know, they hear a story and they say, well, what difference does it make? You know, this man is successful. You know, why do we need to perfect him further? And they miss the fact that, you know what, maybe it wasn't so easy along the way. You know, maybe there were things that were difficult for you along the way.
Well, not only was it not easy, but I think that I've missed, you know, missed fulfilling some of my potential because of it. So I'm successful, but I could have been more successful.
And the difference between anxiety and ADHD can be difficult, at least from speaking as a pediatrician with seeing these patients in interest. When you're anxious, you don't think clearly, you get distracted, you can't concentrate as well. So it can be difficult, and addressing it correctly is just like making the difference in diagnosis between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, for example. The treatment is different, and one's much more effective, and the other may not be effective at all.
Right. And drug therapy may not be the way to go.
May not be.
But to not consider it out of fear or feeling that, you know, that's an admission of poor parenting skills or something like that, is they're missing the boat. You know,
okay.
If it's something that working closely with your doctor, you determine that that's a possible option that you need to explore, I say explore it, you know.
Thanks for your call, Mark.
You bet.
Yep. Good luck. Here's an email that I think is important to address. The writer suggests, what has a study been done on the effect of diet on ADHD or ADD?
There have been studies done because people have been interested in that for a very long time. And the studies that have been done have not pointed to a dietary component with ADHD in the sense that sugar or red food dye or preservatives don't cause ADHD. You know, many parents will say that they notice that their kids get, you know, you name it, fill in the blank of the symptoms, if they have these things. You know, this is unscientific. I wouldn't be surprised if some children are very reactive to different kinds of substances and they react to them. But when it has been systematically studied, at least, you know, can these things cause ADHD? The answer has consistently been no.
Yeah, I would I'd echo that. There's still lots of families who think that there may be an effect, and it's almost impossible for any one family or any one patient to be their own control and tell what's effective and not. And in the best studies, almost no evidence that it's a dietarily related or treated disorder.
It's very hard to counteract that impression, though, and
absolutely,
it's something that's fascinating. I mean, I did an article recently on vision therapy. You have the same, which is basically the behavioral optometrists who say that they can treat all kinds of symptoms through eye exercises. And you have all of medical opinion and all sort of controlled studies arrayed against them, and parents who absolutely swear by what they do and speak of just miracle cures for their kids. And I think it's a fascinating phenomenon, one that, you know, I imagine that you encounter in your practice all the time in various areas.
Well, yeah, you hear it, and I mean, there's, you know, it doesn't lend well to discussion and trying to change people's minds. From my point of view, the possibility could be that there was not the correct diagnosis from the get-go. There is the subjective aspect of what we want to believe and what we want to see, and our denial of diagnosis. There's lots of reasons for people to think that something works and it doesn't. And again, it's very, very difficult in an individual family or individual person to really do the controls and really get the best evidence for what works and what doesn't work. Here is an email. Thanks so much for airing the program. Much of what you discussed is very familiar. I have a bright, interested 10-year-old who was diagnosed with the inattentive form of ADHD at age 7. For 3 years, we avoided trying medication, but as she moved up through the grades, her homework load increased. And as Ms. Warder described, it takes an impossibly long time, 2 to 4 more hours a day, for her to get through her work. She understands the material, but she can stare at the page of problems indefinitely. We finally decided to try medication. We found that it did not work for her, various drugs resulting in not sleeping, not eating, or simply not improving her ability to focus. We're now back to looking at other approaches. You mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't have a good track record for this disorder. Are there other approaches that you've come across that might show attention? I'm interested in your comments.
Well, I mean, I'm not a doctor. I think that, you know, you probably have things to say about this. You probably encounter this question from patients. I will say that there, you know, there's someone at State University of New York, William Pelham, who was kind of the premier person in terms of developing behavioral therapies for ADHD. And, you know, when you these behavioral therapies generally can target behavior, which inattentive ADHD, sort of you don't have the problem of bad behavior or impulsive behavior. You have the problem of focusing on the page, exactly what the person who emailed described. And he says that he can help with that, that there are strategies for helping with that in terms of sort of having fewer problems on a page, et cetera. I have to say that I have never heard any other doctor back that up very strongly. There are people now who believe in various forms of brain training software, think that they can work. Once again, there aren't controlled studies to back them up, but people varying from Ned Halliwell, Edward Halliwell, who wrote Driven to Distraction, and if you look at his website, he has some brain training things that he believes in. There's someone locally where I am in Washington named William Stixrud, who has another kind of software he believes in. And I, you know, again, I have to say that there aren't vast bodies of clinical literature to back them up, but you know, I can understand where the person who wrote in is coming from and the frustration of wanting to do something to help a child, and you know, can imagine that in those situations when medication can't work, you might want to try some of these alternatives. The problem is that they're often very expensive, they're not reimbursed by health insurance, and you don't have good science behind them. So it's a gamble, and you know, you need to have some extra money lying around to be able to put behind them.
Yeah, I would agree with everything you said. I'm going to add a little bit to this email by saying that I think the evidence is pretty good that about 80% of children treated appropriately will respond. And that doesn't mean that they may not have some side effects, which should be addressed. But if 80% respond and a patient doesn't respond, the first thing should be to perk up your ears is, are we looking at the right diagnosis? Are there other factors that are not being addressed that are important as well? Not saying that the diagnosis was right or wrong in here, but it needs to be addressed if 80% of the time we can treat people with this disorder effectively. I am aware that there are a study people who are saying that some behavioral modification, cognitive behavioral therapy, biofeedback, and various things have been worked and work. And I don't think they're the standard of care at this point when compared head to head. There are ways to approach that, and I think you can also help kids learn to cope better with their distractibility by various helpful suggestions. And so all of those things can be put together. But again, you want to look for really good evidence for effectiveness, particularly if you're spending a lot of time. And remember, everything has risks, every treatment. If you're spending a lot of money on something that's not going to work, you're wasting your resources, which could be used elsewhere. Judith, back to you, and maybe in our last 5 minutes or so, I'll address some answers here. What might be things that we need to be doing to help improve understanding and treatment of the mental health kids of children and adults, and adolescents, I should say?
I think the first thing is to cut through some of the stigma and the misunderstanding and the nasty things that we say about these kids and the parents, and realize that, you know, again, that these disorders are real and they're serious and they need to be taken seriously. I think that, you know, we have some hope with health reform that just passed. There is parity required for mental health coverage in the plans that will be in these to-be-created exchanges. So that will help some people get better access to mental health care. But, you know, there's a terrible problem generally of access when it comes to kids' mental health care in particular. There are only 7,000 child psychiatrists in the country. There are many rural areas where there are no child psychiatrists or child psychologists at all. There is also a provision in health reform to do some tuition reimbursement for students who are willing to go to underserved areas in child psychiatry. So that, you know, will give some help. There's also a big problem, at least in my area, of practitioners who don't participate in health insurance. So even if they are plentiful, as they are in the D.C. area, they're incredibly expensive. And most people just can't afford it. And, you know, that's part of the part. We've been talking about medication. We really haven't talked much about therapy. You know, there are such good results shown for cognitive behavior therapy with depression and anxiety, but mm-hmm. it costs mm-hmm. a fortune. Mm-hmm. And most families can't do it. And I think it's just criminal that parents' hands are tied in terms of what they can do for their children because of what they can or can't afford. So I think that, you know, part of this is an insurance issue, and I think part of it is I think that, you know, practitioners need to agree to take on more patients who have insurance and who aren't going to pay out of pocket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the comparability issue that Obama wants to get through, let me put that in some perspective as well. We often see pharmaceutical companies comparing their product with placebo, which makes sense, and it shows that it's better than placebo. What we're not seeing and what we probably won't see at all from pharmaceutical companies is comparing each other's products. So we really don't know often best of class what's the best. And that's been a problem since the government has gotten out of funding a lot of this this kind of therapeutic research. So that's a problem. You mentioned also a very important comment that the true epidemic, as you say, is the lack of quality of care, which you've alluded to.
It's terrible. In fact, the fact that children are very often getting these diagnoses and treatments without getting proper evaluations. I mean, real solid evaluations for these disorders, which are often so complicated. You know, and as you've said, anxiety and ADHD can look at the same thing. It takes time to tease all of that out, but it also is very expensive, and insurance often won't cover those evaluations or covers it partly or throw up all kinds of roadblocks when parents try to get reimbursement, and that's a really serious problem. Also, the therapies that are done very often don't meet, you know, standards of effectiveness. You don't know what kind of therapy a child psychologist or social worker is going to be doing with a child, you know, whether it's at all evidence-based, whether it's going to help or whether it's going to lead nowhere after a lot of time and money. And, you know, I know that there are a lot of people within the profession of psychology who would like to see their field put on a more kind of scientific footing so that therapists are using techniques that have some kind of scientific backing in the first place. Of course, others find that just offensive and, you know, prefer to have a more kind of artisanal vision of what they do. But it's a problem for parents. Again, you know, resources are such an issue. And as you said, it's a horrible stress for families if they're going to commit significant resources to a treatment that maybe isn't going to work.
Judith, thanks immensely for taking the time today, and I want to make sure our listeners hear again about your book, We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. There's a link to Judith's website on our website, and it's an excellent book with very well-documented approach and understanding of this current issue. Thanks again, Judith.
Thank you so much.
Next week we'll return, or actually it'll be 2 weeks, I'll return with Sarah Jansen of the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's a scientist for them, and we'll be discussing the effects of various chemicals on reproductive health. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.